Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Oram, and I'm joined today by Mr. John Indris. John, how are you today?
Well, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, no, it's always great to have you on. And Ms. Sarah Gott. Sarah, how are you?
Oh, good. Well, thanks. Fine.
If you hear chirping birds in the background, it's just because Sarah is in a sort of middle of a cornucopia of life and wonders of spring are all around her. So that's what that sound is. Anyway, let's get started with some of the interesting stories that are afield today. And the first is the news that the Hawks have arrested some people in the Free State for being involved with a large corruption scandal referred to as an asbestos project. So the Hawks have arrested several people, including prominent businessman Edwin Sodi, involved in the theft of more than $200 million from the Free State Department of Human Settlements under the guise of an asbestos audit in the province. This came just after Sodi had testified before the Zondo Commission. Apparently, the Hawks had a sort of warrant out for his arrest for quite a while, but they decided to only act on it once he had finished giving testimony to the Zondo Commission. The arrests have also included the department's former head, Timi Motse Mokesi, and Tabane Zulu. The head of the Directorate of Priority Crime said that there are seven people that we want to fetch here. If we find them, we've had our warrants for some time. The allegations against them are that they were involved in awarding a corrupt tender for 230 million rand to carry out work that only cost 21 million rand. So this looks like a pretty big bust of some pretty senior people for, 230 million rands, no small fish. So I guess the question here is, are we finally seeing Ramaphosa's long-awaited swoop on corruption and crime? John, what's your take on this?
I would love to believe that that is the case, but my cynicism and past experience has shown me that we would do well to wait and see if the government really is serious about cracking down on corruption. Now, it is encouraging that some of the people arrested include somewhat higher ranking officials, such as the former Mangaung mayor, Oli Mlamleni. So that is encouraging. But at the same time, we are mindful of the tone that President Ramaphosa used in his seven-page letter about wanting to fight corruption, which seemed to focus more on the desire to create the impression of fighting corruption rather than actually fighting corruption. So it is possible that what the government is doing here is creating a great deal of turbulence and signs of activity and action and media reports that all look like a breakthrough, but that in fact it may be a damp squib and not go very far.
The other fear, I guess, is that this could simply be, rather than a general sweep against corruption, more like a targeted strike against Ramaphosa's enemies. So there's some suggestion that this is the first step in towards taking down the web that supports ANC Secretary General Ace Magashula, who's famously not part of the Ramaphosa faction of the ANC. Sarah, do you think that could be what's going on here?
It certainly could be, but you know, there are two things that really come out of this. The one is that if they'd defrauded the state to the amount of 21 million rand, we probably would not have noticed it. But inflating it to 225 million it's like begging to be noticed and ultimately dealt with. So I think that's probably the part of the problem with a lot of the corruption that's going in. The escalation of the cost of the corruption is so high that it's ridiculous. And because it's ridiculous, it ultimately will receive attention in the press and hopefully the prosecuting authorities. I'm inclined to agree with John. I think certainly if Ace Magashule gets dealt with, that's a strike. But on the other hand, by all accounts and from the figures that our colleague Anthea Jeffrey researched, I think she found that 41 out of 80 NEC members were implicated in really high level, expensive corruption, if I can put it that way. And this suggests that I'm not sure that Ramaphosa can or will go that far in making sure the corruption is dealt with, because he's got so many people within who would be fingered in such in corruption. I think the possibility is that could sink the ANC completely. So I was more excited, to be honest, by the fact that, and it's not much in the circumstances, but we'll do for the meantime, that Richard Ndluli got a 5-year jail sentence.
Yes, so that's excellent news indeed. And of course, I just did some sort of back of the envelope calculations here. So if we assume an RDP house costs around 60,000 rand to build, which I think is vaguely reasonable, then you're looking at 230 million rand could have built 3,833 RDP houses, which gives you a scale of give you an idea of how big this defrauding was. John?
I just wanted to follow up on what Sarah was saying, that the degree of overinflation is quite remarkable, and that maybe if it hadn't been quite as ambitious, it wouldn't have been noticed. But I do think that is a sign of brazenness and of lack of accountability. So there must be a lot of consternation about in ANC circles at the moment that there are any consequences at all, because the rule has been for the better part of a decade, if not longer, that you can do anything and get away with it. And that suddenly that rule seems to be changing somewhat.
Just to add to the sort of on your comment to the corruption, I mean, I think I read fairly recently, somebody had made a comment to the effect that most countries have corruption. But if you sort of, commit a bit of corruption, say for 20 million rand, but use another 21 million to build a few, the population will care a lot less. The problem here is that a tender goes to a businessman who knows nothing about the subject, and after that, absolutely nothing happens. So it's brazenness, it's recklessness. I mean, I think you've got to be fairly sort of, you've got to plan your corruption perhaps a bit better.
Indeed. I think just following on from what you said, Sarah, about the amount of the ANC that's implicated in this, I think that's a very important point, because one of the things I think that keeps the ANC together at this point, as everyone is fond of saying, the ANC is a broad church, and there's actually a lot of factions which would like to do their own thing, or perhaps wouldn't be that loyal to the central organization if they didn't require the patronage that the ANC hands out. And so Ramaphosa's big risk here, I think, is that if he really does start rooting out a lot of corrupt people, he's going to destabilize the party. And this is possibly why ANC leaders have always been so afraid to, when they weren't involved in corruption themselves, like Zuma, that they've always been a bit afraid to tackle this, because if you take apart the sort of patronage web that keeps the whole thing together, even if you don't get overthrown by the party, you may also see the party split into 1,000 pieces. Do you think that's a reasonable assessment, John?
Absolutely. I think increasingly corruption is the glue that holds the party together. And if you start dissolving that glue, then the party falls apart. So it is a very difficult situation for any clean ANC leaders to be in, to decide what to do about the situation. Very, very tricky.
Go ahead. Can I just add exactly to that? And remember, two months ago, Cyril Ramaphosa reiterated something you said before, and that is that he'd rather be known for the president that held the ANC together than for how he led the country.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I think also it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, if the patronage taps are turned off, what a lot of sort of ANC leaders of the middle rank could do is if they think they can start their own party, because we have a proportional system, you only need 0.25% of the vote to actually get into parliament, as the ATM demonstrated, which has long been rumored to be a Zuma front. It got, I think, 2 or 3 seats in the national parliament. So I can see a scenario where if the patronage taps were turned off, suddenly you would get 1,000 tiny parties that would all start up and start eating up little bits of seats from in ANC strongholds or from ANC supporters. John?
Just a quick comment on the SAA invoice. The invoice for flying to Zimbabwe, where the... A plane trip to Harare was used to ferry some ANC senior leaders to what was an official meeting between the South African minister and the Zimbabwean government. And the ANC promised to pay back the money, that the cost of that flight, but the bill was only for 105,000 rand. And I think that's a sign that they're wanting to be seen to be taking action, but not too much. It's a very low amount.
I think in addition, docking 3 months' salary from the minister responsible is, again, being seen to take action, but I don't think any of us think that that's action enough. It's effectively a slap on the wrist. Firing her would probably have been more appropriate. That won't happen, though.
Yeah, of course. I think that's the big taboo that needs to really be broken here, is that people need to actually get fired. Because it's, you can sort of shuffle chairs around and sacrifice some non-key players to the cops, but at the end of the day, if senior people aren't being fired for incompetence and for even having the whiff of corruption about them, then we're not really going to make a lot of headway here. Anyway, let's move on. Oh, sorry, do you have something to add?
No, I was just going to say, you were talking about the ATM.
yes.
I think that's Jimmy Money's party. Isn't that what Ace Magashule has just been cleared by the public protector of helping to set up? In other words, he had no involvement in setting up the ATM, she says.
I think
it was literally the sort of start of the week, the little nugget.
I didn't see that story. That is quite interesting, and I wonder how thorough that finding is, because I think when Jimmy Money is involved, the chances that it's got the Zuma faction's fingerprints all over it is quite high. Anyway, let's move on to our other story, which is that government is looking at reopening international travel. They made the announcement, I believe, yesterday, but they said that there would still be a list of countries that are that people are not allowed to travel here from. Naledi Pandor said that any travelers entering South Africa need a negative COVID-19 test performed no more than 72 hours before departure, and they also would be screened upon arrival. Should they show symptoms and test positive and could not self-isolate, they'd be sent to a state-identified facility. Pandor said travelers would need mandatory travel insurance to cover costs arising from this. So I think one of the things that's come out about COVID, one of the least controversial policies for its effectiveness, because obviously we've been critics of lockdown. We don't think that those work. But I think it's pretty reasonable to say that travel bans do work. I think Taiwan has probably showed this. I think Vietnam, to a certain degree, has showed this. So I think it's very important that we get the travel, what countries we're allowing travel to and from, correct. And I'm a little bit concerned by this list. So I'm not sure if this is a comprehensive list, but this is the one being reported by Eyewitness News, and it includes a large number of countries around the world which travel is banned from completely. India, which is currently one of the world's hotspots for COVID, the UK and France, which, well, they're seeing a slight rise in cases, but I don't think they're quite hotspots again yet. Russia, which has had a very big COVID problem. The United States, which of course continues to have a big COVID problem. Mexico, which is got slightly more COVID cases than South Africa, but no travel bans to anywhere in Africa. A lot of East Asian countries are fine, but there's some anomalies here. One is, according to this list, Brazil, which I believe is the third highest number of infections in the world and is still growing at something like 30,000 cases a day, is not on the list. Indonesia, which has only recently turned around its number of cases, it has something like 200,000 confirmed cases, is not on the list. And Turkey, which has a still increasing number of deaths and infections, is not on the list. So I'm a little bit curious as to how this list came to be. Sara, what do you think is going on here?
It's actually quite difficult to tell, because it's a real hodgepodge. And also, you know, you're saying it's Africa's open, but a fair number of African countries we have no information on, no statistical information, no data information, nothing to do with COVID.
I think that's a very important point, because a lot of African countries may even have worse infections than us, but because their testing regimes are so bad, we just don't really know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I heard an interview last night with a woman, obviously, sort of in the tourist industry, and she was pulling no punches about the fact that apparently business travelers can come in from anywhere. I'm not sure whether, you know, what the limits are in terms of what they have to show or prove. But she said the fact that business travelers could come in, but there were so many restrictions on leisure tourism. You know, she was furious because she said it didn't, and with all the restrictions, it wasn't going to make much difference to the South African market at this stage. So the market will really have to wait probably another 3 or 4 months before foreign tourists can come in. And, you know, we're not known for making it as easy as it should be in the best of times for tourists to come in. So we have a tourism industry despite government regulation. It's very. Let me put it this way: I wouldn't be in a rush to either leave or come into South Africa at all, because you just never know when you might be carted off to one of these government facilities. God help us.
I've just noticed that according to the graphic that the government distributed, Spain is not on the list. Yesterday, Spain had 11,000 new cases. So this seems once again a little bit weird. It's kind of like sort of opening, but sort of not opening, and then kind of in not very logical in terms of the way that it's being done. John, is this kind of just a repeat of the way that lockdown worked? Lots of rules and not a lot of them making a lot of sense.
It's possible. There was also a bit of confusion, I think, at the press conference yesterday. So there are different lists in circulation. There was an update from the Home Affairs Department yesterday evening where they said earlier today a list of high-risk countries was read at a press conference. Unfortunately, this list was not exhaustive and might also have included some countries by mistake. So there is a new list, and I'm looking at the new list, which does include Brazil, but not Indonesia and Spain. So I think your point stands that it is still not quite clear on what basis these countries were identified. Apparently, the approach taken was to divide all the countries in the world into one of three groups, which is high risk, medium risk, low risk. Any country which has a higher risk than South Africa has restricted travel to South Africa. Any country that has lower risk than South Africa has less restricted travel to South Africa, which sort of makes sense. But the rules are quite stringent for travelers from high-risk countries. So the first thing to note is that leisure travelers, so tourists, will not be permitted. So I understand if friends and colleagues in the tourism industry are not terribly heartened by this news at this stage. And even for business travelers, the rules are quite strict. So it will only be people with scarce and critical skills, including diplomats, repatriated persons, investors, and people participating in professional sports. So if you are a general business person wanting to do some deals in South Africa, you'd better find out what sort of scarce skills you've got. Otherwise, you won't be traveling here anytime soon.
May we have as many investors being keen to fight our COVID rules and come in here. We should be so lucky.
Yeah, indeed. Exactly.
And I was just looking, you know, the discussion of lists and there's a humorous quality to it, and I think it could form the plot of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I also wonder if tourists are completely banned from France, Britain, America, India, and Portugal. You know, these are places which send a lot of tourists, I think, to South Africa. So I really wonder how much the tourist industry is really going to be supported by this opening.
Not much.
Anyway, do you have any final thoughts, John?
Just the importance of these regulations in terms of tourism. And I know you've covered it before on the show, tourism being such an important industry for South Africa. In terms of job creation, contribution to GDP, the number of people it employs, the image it creates for South Africa and the world, it's a pity that we are still so restricted because of the COVID regulations.
Indeed.
Just to say, my husband and I went to see the flowers in Namaqualand, and you could almost see the palpable relief that places were filling up with South African tourists. But of course, they're waiting for the international travellers to get there because obviously the money spent is on a much wider scale.
Definitely. Our tourist industry is really not going to recover until we get those high-paying foreign tourists. Mm. Mm. Anyway, let's move on to another story about lockdown, COVID, and economic disaster. And this is from a follow-up study by the National Income Dynamics Study Coronavirus Rapid Mobile Survey, NIDSCRAM. and this study follows one that was done in May and June about the level of hunger in the country, and it found that the level of hunger for anyone in the household has declined from in May it was around 22%, and in August it went down to about 16%. And for children, it went from 15% of children experiencing hunger to 11%. And it looks like, generally speaking, there has been about a 20% improvement in the ability of households to buy food across the board in since the height of the lockdown. But the more concerning part of this is that food insecurity in South Africa appears to be at least twice as high as it was in 2016. In the first study, they said that 47% of respondents had indicated their household ran out of money to buy food. That was in May of this year, and that's now down to 37. Then that declined to 37% in the month of June. The study also found that around 27% of South Africa's children have stunted growth and not the appropriate height for their age, as a result of poor nutrition. And there's been little change to the stunting rate in recent years. And the COVID-19 pandemic may, in fact, make this much worse. So we may see that number going up towards 30%. Sara, we're in a bit of trouble, aren't we? If
we are able
to grow properly.
Yeah, I'd like to. I mean, the stunted growth is a horrifying figure, but it also is something much worse, and that is that if you're hungry, if you're not being properly fed, or you're malnourished, it's not going to only affect your growth; it's going to affect your intellectual development. So you've got a larger number of kids who will essentially go through the schooling system and probably not end up with anywhere near a decent education, even if there were one to be had, because the growth is stunted in brain as well as in the body, and that should be really, really very, very concerning, because we there is no way a country that would like to see itself develop and grow can afford to have that large, even if it was caused in a crisis that we didn't expect, but that large a number of children whose growth and mental faculties may be affected by the fact that they had little or nothing to eat.
And of course, there's a certain type of lefty commenter, I think, who likes to sort of bash the idea of economic growth at all costs and how we need to be all focused on other things. But John, isn't this really what it looks like when you don't have economic growth?
Yeah, it's also just thinking of your comment about lefty commentators. I think conservatives or classical liberals are Well, we do believe in a small state, but I do think that this is one of these issues where there is an argument to be made for the state to step in. Childhood stunting because of insufficient nutrition is just not something that should be happening in a country of our resources, both for moral reasons but also for practical reasons in terms of the growth potential that it means for the country. And it does remind me a bit of the fact that during the lockdown, I believe the Western Cape continued to feed school children on the school feeding scheme, and the national government or the National Health Education Minister took them to court to get them to stop. And that is a harrowing thought that anybody could do such a thing. That is part of the whole big mess that COVID has landed us in. The same study also points out that this has had quite a devastating effect on jobs and on grants. So the authors point out that between 2009 and 2019, South Africa created 2.4 million jobs. So 2.4 million jobs in a decade. But it looks like we lost about the same number in just 4 months during the lockdown. So, it's effectively a decade's worth of job growth lost within 4 months. And at the same time, also, if you include the 4 million recipients of the new 350 Rand COVID relief loan, grant, added as many new recipients onto the grant system in 4 months as we added in the previous 10 years. And this is another example of the jaws of the hippo, which are wide open. So we've got fewer and fewer people in work and more people dependent on the government and on the dole. And that is a very worrying development.
Exactly, especially as the government looks like it's going to run out of money. As we're seeing now, we're scrambling, and there'll be an update to the budget this month, which will provide more insight on what our current financial situation is. Sarah?
What it really illustrates is the single-minded, almost lunacy of the ANC following a distinct socialist model that has failed. And as a consequence, it may run out of money because there are going to be less tax being paid, and that's where it would first rely on money to deal with this sort of need. The other thing is that you've got to have growth to deal with all of these things. Growth equals taxes. Taxes can then be widely spent. And then, of course, you have the absurdity of trying to bail out a real vanity project in the form of SAA, when really other companies, other organizations will pick up the slack of our air flying needs. But what the government's going to struggle with is the expectation of continuing to pay grants that it's going to have less and less money available to pay. So it's got itself into, tragically for South African people, it's got itself into a bind I don't think it can get out of.
Right, and as we've seen an economic crisis this year and a health crisis of sorts, we will now probably see a political crisis when suddenly the government has to stop giving out wage increases to public sector employees and suddenly starts having to cut down on grants. Is that a reasonable assumption, John?
Yeah, I think the government will try everything it can before it cuts down on grants or on the public wage bill. But it is caught between so many rocks and hard places at the moment. Mm. I don't think it knows where to turn. Should it ask for more money, try to get more loans? I think it would like to do that. That's getting more and more difficult. Should it try to increase taxes? Also very difficult, with people, with households squeezed already. Lots of people emigrating, lots of wealth being moved offshore, and the potential for raising taxes shrinking by the day. Should it cut the public salary wage bill? Very difficult thing to do. Should it fight corruption? Also very difficult. So we're moving into a narrowing canyon. And soon we won't be able to move in any direction except, maybe backwards. And the only way out is economic growth. There's simply no other way. We won't be able to borrow our way out of trouble. We won't be able to tax our way out of trouble. We won't be able to print our way out of trouble. fighting corruption won't be good enough. It won't generate enough revenue, in addition to being very politically difficult. And growth is the only way. That's what the single-minded focus needs to be on now.
You see, and the problem with that is that the answer is sort of broadly simple in the sense of shaft the policies, the low-growth policies that you've been wedded to for the past 26 years, and follow a free market system. Mm. That's a place to start. That's the problem, of course, is that wedded to a philosophy that produces policies that are just absolutely counterproductive.
Indeed. And so with a call for death to socialist ideology and long life to free markets, I hope that everyone listening has a wonderful week. We shall see you on Monday. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you are listening to it on, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And we'll see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone.